All right, cool. The meeting is being recorded. Okay, then. Hello, hello. It is Tuesday, August 6th, 2024. If you want to know what happened on this day, you can just, go back in your history books. I'm speaking to the future now, not the people who are here in the present. In the future, you will wonder what was going on August 6th. All right, friends, nice to see everyone. We are going to start with a period of meditation that I will guide for a certain portion. So we'll sit for about 20 minutes, and then I'll talk for maybe the first half of that, and then have a little quiet time, and then we'll reflect on some sort of dharma and or recovery as we've been doing here for quite a while. So, settling back into a comfortable meditation posture. And ideally to come into stillness. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, turning the attention inward. Just starting by connecting with the body and how you're holding your body, the posture, and then the sensations in the body. There is this kind of transition, beginning of meditation, where we're transitioning from our ordinary movements and mental activities into a more structured practice of focused attention. Or just giving yourself time to settle might involve conscious relaxation of the body. I like to relax the jaw. Release the shoulders, soften the belly, but there's a sense of physical letting go even as we are working at a kind of mental letting go of following the streams of thought. Attachment to the th thoughts that arise. Then starting to focus the attention on the breath. Typically, we use the breath at the nostrils or the belly, either focusing on the sensations of air moving in and out, or the movement of belly rising and falling, the abdomen. This is a very simple thing to pay attention to can actually take some time before we figure out what it means to be mindful of the breath. such a really subtle experience, something we typically ignore. Well, we take some time to study, discover what the breath feels like. See that there's a difference between the in-breath and the out-breath. What does an in-breath feel like? What does an out-breath feel like? And the attention itself, so slippery. We're not used to paying attention to something so simple, so undramatic as the breath. So it's easy to get caught in thoughts. Might even start thinking about meditation, thinking about what we're doing, thinking about the breath. And when you notice the mind wandering like this, just letting go, coming back, reconnect with the breath, relax again. Nothing to accomplish here. Nothing to figure out. Just sitting and breathing. Each time we come back to the breath can be another stage of letting go. Just releasing through the body, mind spacious, open, receptive. Notice if there's an underlying attitude in the mind, in the heart, whether you are coming to your practice with kindness, openness, or with a sense of striving, judgment. These subtle attitudes can have a strong effect on how our practice unfolds. Really want to be gentle towards ourselves, kind. Not enter into a competition with ourselves, or comparing our meditation to some model or some image. Just showing up is the heart of practice. You've already done the important work. Right. Well, welcome again. If I'm not mistaken, seeing a few names I've not seen here before, so welcome to everyone who is new or old or in between. And ordinarily I besides guiding meditation, I talk, as I said, about Dharma and recovery, usually some theme that's sort of up for me, often semi-improvised, if I can dare say, as many of you know. Today I don't have anything. I got nothing. Not sure why that is. Various causes and conditions. So that gives me the opportunity to open it up and see what questions there are from folks, whether about meditation or the Dharma in general or something about recovery. Okay, Robin, you go.
Hi, Kevin. Hi, everybody.
All right.
Okay, so I have a question, and I was wondering if you would be willing to share for you what is your general usual spiritual practice as far as how many times a day, how long? That's curiosity. On my part, I don't know if that's something appropriate for here, but that's my question.
I'm certainly happy to talk about that. I do want to avoid setting up my practice as some sort of model. I try, but I'm just digging for a cough drop. And certainly, it changes and varies. And I don't think of my practice as just meditation or sobriety. Or even necessarily just contained within particular times of day or framework. I do try to practice these principles in all my affairs, as much as I might fail at that. But just to specifically answer your question, my daily meditation practice usually, 90% of the time, it's what I do after I get dressed in the morning. So it's before. Before I get going with the day, I think it's, for me, it's really important to start my day with meditation, and it tends to help my emotional state for one thing, and to kind of feel like it clears out my head, and also seem feel like it also helps my body. I think the relaxation aspect of it. So I typically sit for 45 minutes, I don't do much in terms of form. I work with the breath, I work with the body, I work with feelings, and at times I apply particular practices like, in the last few years, Anapanasati. So I kind of, there's 16 steps to that, so I can work with that structure. But that's not really typical of what I do. But sometimes just to give myself something to do, or to gather my attention a little stronger, and then there is some loving kindness practice, although I think of loving kindness largely as integrated into mindfulness. That is to say that, I try to, when When I'm sitting and something difficult shows up, or I find I'm really wandering off, that when I come back, I try to do it with this very gentle, kind attitude of kind of softness and kind of compassion toward myself. And all of this is not really verbalized in the mind. It's more just an attitude that I've learned to sort of apply. Because I find the breath itself can be a sort of softening quality that you can kind of open and breathe in and have a sense of kind of soft gentleness towards yourself. So that's, I know that's a little bit vague, but I think that one of the things that happens when you've been meditating for 40 or 50 years is that the practice sort of devolves into something formless and organic that doesn't have a lot of structure to it. But I do end my sittings by, I usually, particularly lately, I've been using the phrases, the loving kindness phrases I've been using with you guys from the Metta Sutta, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. And I'll do that again today at the end. And as I've talked about, when I recite those words, radiating kindness through over the entire world, I first think of my body and my, myself as the whole world, which the Buddha kind of talks about at times, that we contain the whole world in this fathom-long body. And so I kind of, and this is after I've been sitting for 40 minutes or so. So that it tends to have a very buoyant effect on my mind state and the way I feel. It's like really lifts me up. I can really feel a brightness when I do that just for a couple of minutes. And then I recite the five daily reflections. Which the Buddha said, we should recite these daily. We should contemplate these daily, which are, I am of the nature to age, to sicken, and to die. All that is mine, dear and delightful, will change and vanish. So the first four are just about everything is impermanent. And then the fifth one is about karma. I'm born of my karma, heir to my karma, related to my karma, supported by my karma, owner of my karma. Whatever karma or whatever actions I take, whether wholesome or unwholesome, these I will inherit. So, in other words, whatever I do, I'm going to get the results of that. And then I just recite the three refuges. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. And I just kind of try to feel what that means to me. So that's the formal aspects of my practice. But as I say, I do try to bring mindfulness to my breath regularly through the day, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, especially like when strong feelings are coming up. Mindfulness of speech is really, really important, particularly in relationships. And so, to me, that quality of trying to watch my mind and my feelings and what's going on and how I'm reacting through the day is really critical. And then the other thing is that I don't frame my practice. I also, in terms of time, I think of my practice as daily, but I also think of it as, doing a retreat each year. I try to go on a meditation retreat every year of, I try to a minimum of a week of silent practice. And often over the last couple decades, a lot of the times those have been self retreats. At times, I go on community retreats at times as well. Last year was a long, long group retreat I was on. But and I will say that certainly doing this is a really important part of my practice, teaching. Anybody who steps into the role of a Dharma teacher, I think, is naturally feels a responsibility toward their community and toward themselves and toward the Dharma itself, to the Buddha, to try to embody as best they can the teachings, and to then study the teachings and to understand them. So study is a really important part of practice. For me, it's not something so much that I do every day, although I should say I often these days I've taken up the habit of having a cup of tea before my meditation. I don't always do that, but while I'm drinking my cup of tea, I'm usually reading some Dharma. So that's also part of my practice. And then finally, I'll say writing on the Dharma and on recovery is really a critical part of my spiritual practice. And that's also something I do on not quite a daily, but regular, like probably 4 to 5 times a week. So that's about all I can say. It's a good question. Any opportunity to talk about myself, Robin, you got the right question. So, John Manilov, hi.
Hey, Kevin. As the session started off, and how we live in this world, and it's, we can't avoid events, right? And it made me think of, in terms of my practice in AA, one of those things that I've done is, it's in one of the stories where you pray for somebody for 2 weeks and pray that they have everything I want for myself. Health, happiness, and prosperity. And it's, I think it's similar to what, you end your session with, but it's obviously very AA sort of oriented. And I appreciate what you've described as well, but it, I've prayed for some of our prominent figures repeatedly. So, your thoughts on that or not, either way, it's fine. But I did make that observation when I started.
Thank you. I mean, I will say that, I mean, if we're particularly talking about, the difficult figures, that I think it's a perennial challenge how to hold them in our minds, because certainly, anger and ill will arise on a regular basis, and the way the Buddha talks about that is, it's not about them, it's about you. It's about what are you creating for yourself and the suffering that you feel when you have hatred for someone. He says that when you hate your enemy, you are giving your enemy what they want because you're making yourself miserable. And that's really interesting, because I can't, and I talked about this in my book, Living Kindness, about the idea that it can be very difficult to generate love towards the difficult person or the enemy, but that, as the Buddha often talks about, non-ill will. If I can practice non-ill will, so that it's more of like about letting go of that unwholesome and destructive and ultimately self-destructive energy within myself, so that I'm not hating and generating this feeling in the body, and really what that does to the mind and body. That's kind of my way of working with that. It is to just not hate. And I fail at that on a regular basis, but yeah, I mean, because I am very mentally, at least, engaged in politics, and many of my daughter works in politics, in Congress, and she's not a congressperson. I don't think that's going to happen, but she's working for a congressperson. And so my conversations with her and her, are very much on those lines. And I think, when I started, I mean, I can go back even further, but when I started meditation at that time, I was very detached from the world of politics and social issues, and I was just like into my head, and my meditation, and like trying to fix myself and my own suffering. And but and I and I that's okay, I mean, that's what I needed to do at that time. I don't like regret that particularly, but I certainly feel that being connected and caring about engaging in the world in this way can be and it is a natural outgrowth of spiritual of living a life based on spiritual principles. It's not for everybody, and I understand when people feel like, oh, they want to keep that separate, because it can be very triggering. And it is true that it's a very unwholesome world. It's a world of ego and violence and anger, striving for power and all of that. But I also don't like to leave it to all those people who are generated, who are motivated by those things. I'd like to have some people involved in constructing our world, who care about, spiritual principles, who care about compassion. So anyway, that should be enough for now. Carolyn, hello.
Kevin, thank you so much. I'm really excited to join today. This is my first time here,
I
and
was wondering, I sometimes don't see notice everybody, but you seemed new. Welcome.
so my friend actually told me about this link. I didn't even realize you'd be leading it, and I literally I'm just kind of I'm very floored, and I'm excited to just be able to talk to you and be able to be here. Just a bit of background. I got in I have about a little bit over 100 days sober right now. And I got sober originally in 2018, started with Recovery Dharma, and was sober for like 4 years. And some terrible stuff happened, and I think I always kind of had in my back pocket, this is, just in case all else goes to hell, I'm gonna, I can drink, So I recently just started in AA in March, and I was always a bit averse to it. And so I'm currently, I've also noticed like a lot of big shift around surrender, and which actually feels like a huge relief. That was not something that was present before. And today I'm actually reading, so I'm doing the steps, but I picked up your book to kind of read, coinciding like with each step, and currently I'm just working step three. And I'm really curious, I'm curious to hear a little bit, about your personal sort of your own experience and your practice around prayer. That's something that, it's interesting because I I've always looked at prayer sort of through this meditative lens of like, may I be happy, may I be, free from suffering, and I do have a practice for sure, but prayer is kind of new to me, and I'm just kind of trying to get ideas and just get open my mind around this idea, because I think it's interesting. I have this very Judeo-Christian view of prayer, and I'm just curious what your practice around that looked like and how it kind of probably changed over time too.
Yeah. All right. Well, first of all, welcome and good on you for the 100 days, and keep it up. And just like surrender is so key, right? Like, especially in establishing our recovery, like just letting go of control and just like just do it, and don't worry about. Even something like prayer is a good example. Like, don't worry about it. Like, you don't have to figure it out, right? Just if it's a useful tool for you, then use it. And it certainly has a great value, I think. First of all, I just want to say, I think people's relationship to prayer and what they are sort of how they are viewing what they are doing when they are praying, or how they're even feeling what they're doing when they're praying, is very personal. So I don't, I have thoughts about it and experience with it, but I also think it's really important for each of us to explore on our own and try to make our own connection, rather than like, oh, this is how I should do it, or this is how I should think about it. Like, again, it's like a surrender. Just feel your way into it and see what you can make of it. When I got sober, I had been through a almost cultish, like new age spiritual trip with this one guru that I talk about in One Breath at a Time. And the one of the benefits of that was it kind of did open me up to prayer and to like God, and like God and prayer. That was fine with me. When I got sober, I just went ahead with it. I wasn't thinking about it. I was trying to connect with it on a felt level, to feel comforted, to feel, I mean, comforted mostly, and to help me to let go. I mean, certainly the Serenity Prayer to me was the prayer that I used the most early in recovery, and I still resort to it at times. Because it is really about surrender. It is really about letting go of control. I mean, that to me is the critical part of it. Grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. That's the opening, and it seems to be sort of the heart of the prayer. But I think the complication comes in when we start to think of prayer as prayer to someone or praying for something. Then we are kind of entering into risky territory, both in terms of the, well, particularly with the praying for something, the falling into kind of grasping an expectation, and then, God either gives me something or doesn't give me something in this sort of, relationship of what's the term for it? It's we have a transactional relationship with God, is the word I'm coming up with. If I surrender, if I believe, if I pray, then you'll do the stuff I want, and that is very problematic, certainly for me. So what happened to me over my recovery was that I evolved away from using language like that, and thinking in terms of a intercessionary prayer where you're asking God to do something. I basically lost faith in that kind of system. I reverted back to my probably more atheistic, although I don't consider myself an atheist. I don't particularly care for that term. But I reverted back to a non-theistic way of viewing my spiritual practice, which then, as you're sort of suggesting, means that prayer doesn't have quite as much of a it doesn't have as much of a role, I would say, but it's also it shifts in terms of the orientation because there isn't this sort of a higher power you're praying to. It's more an internal experience, and it's more trying to, as I sort of said before, sort of derive comfort from the prayer, or to reconnect with, to remind myself of my own understanding. Like that to me is what the Serenity Prayer is, reminding myself, like, oh, don't get caught in trying to control things, you know. So I think the Lord's Prayer as well is about surrender, but it's also about reminding, you know. And you can use, if you, you know, I trans so I translate things like the Lord's Prayer into sort of a Buddhist view. Certainly the Saint Francis Prayer is another one that has a very Buddhist sort of orientation. So yeah, again, I'll just end by saying I think it's really very personal, and that we should, you know, take what we need and leave the rest around prayer, especially, you know, you utilize it, see if it taps into something that, well, I think this will be the last thing I say. It's one of those people in the meeting who goes on 10 minutes after they say this is the last thing I was going to say. See, as soon as I said that, I forgot what I was going to say. So there you go. Well, this is it. Prayer can be helpful in terms of helping us with concentration in meditation. Like you were reciting the words from the loving kindness meditation. So having some structured language that we use in our mind can be a really good way to start our meditation, or to bring our meditation into focus, because it keeps us on track, right? So prayer also has a concentration element that's beneficial. Okay. Thank you, and keep coming back and join us. Stuart, hello. Long wait for you there.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Stuart. I'm a recovering alcoholic for about 3 years and 3 months now. Started out with AA and then moved into AA and Recovery Dharma. I found you through the Spirit Rock Fridays and have been following you and reading your books ever since. I would like your thoughts on attachment and grieving and suffering. We recently had to euthanize one of our family dogs. He was part of the family. I've had a really hard time getting over that. The attachment part of loving something so much and then losing it and grieving and the subsequent suffering is much different than the suffering caused by alcoholism. And something that I can do about. This is like something I can't really do anything about. So it's been a really hard time for me. And I've also had a couple slips over this where I drank a couple nights. And in a way, I'm grateful that I did that because I found that it was no help. And I'm sort of back on track now. But it just kind of it's been a hard time on the path for me. And I just would like your thoughts on the attachment, grieving,
Yeah.
suffering.
Thanks, Stuart. And I'm sorry for your loss, and that, and it, I mean, just to say, you know, we become very attached. We have these relationships with the animals that are Very meaningful and very deep. And it's interesting that, the Buddha, when in terms of practical forms of suffering, the one that I see him talk about the most in the suttas is about death, is about people dying that we care about. But his guidance on it is not like a typical like comforting. It's pretty tough in a way. I don't always find it that helpful, because he's really like, just remember everything is impermanent. And like, okay, well, yeah. I think to me it's about holding suffering without doing harm towards ourselves or towards others, and recognizing, yes, this bigger picture of impermanence, that, oh, this is natural. I mean, when, it's strange to think about humans on this planet. I mean, we can think about all the living beings, but humans are the ones we're most familiar with, that we're all just passing through, and that we're all going to be gone in a short time. And that there were a whole bunch who came before us, and they just, I think of it as sort of this like wheat field that's being harvested. We're all just like being, and so there's, I think practicing with the feeling, breathing with the feeling. I don't primarily try to like get away from that kind of feeling. I mean, I don't want to linger in it and hang out, like, mull it over and keep, stirring myself up. But when those feelings come up, to really like breathe and go, oh, this is grief. This is loss. This is real. This is part of life. This is natural. And it's okay, like, yes, it's okay, and I'm okay. I don't have any great wisdom beyond that, beyond just not getting, see, to me, that turning toward and allowing it in is actually the way that I keep it from triggering something else, triggering the relapse, triggering the drinking, that I'm letting myself feel it. It's because the drinking is a way of avoiding the feeling, right? And there is no, like, you can't flush the feeling away, it's there. And so, my sense, and I don't know that this is what the Buddha meant, but my sense is that part of what the Buddha is trying to teach us is you should really learn to be with your own suffering and be okay with it. Because it's life, it's real, it's part of life. And if you try to keep it in another space, put it in a different room or hide it or suppress it, it's gonna come around and undermine you in some way over time. Now, that doesn't mean we just sit there and go, oh, sad, 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 dead dog, sad, da sad, No, I mean, we still have to, we feel it. And as we're learn in recovery, we keep moving forward. We keep doing, the things that heal us, that take care of us. We spend time with loved ones. We connect with our practice. We take care of our bodies. All the things that we know we need to do, we need to, make sure that we're bringing joy into our lives, because there's, as much as there is loss and that everything is impermanent, there is great opportunity for happiness and joy right here and now. And so, We need to find that balance of like allowing the feelings in and not letting them become like the whole all-encompassing quality. So,
Thank you. That was helpful.
okay, thanks. Deborah Lane, I saw you had your hand up for a while if you wanted to share.
Aren't we finished? What time is it?
Time is relative.
Okay.
I have
All
a
right.
lunch date at 12:30, but if you have to go,
No, I don't have to go. I've been wondering about whether I want to bring it up. I've been practicing reduced harm really pretty successfully. The part where I don't look like an alcoholic, but I am. I finally decided I'm done with the debate. I went on a retreat and I was under a lot of pressure and I drank before I went, and the retreat was, oh my God, it was like a bad, it was great because I liked the teacher a lot, but it was horrible because there was no distraction. And I was in a really bad phase of, like, I couldn't, like, a filmy thing between me and all my practice and everything. It was just, so I think that was my bottom. I'm like, I'm done with this. But I feel a lot of, I've done AA before many times and I really hate it. I'm to say. And I've looked into Dharma recovery, but I talked to somebody from my Sangha last night. I asked him to be my sponsor and he goes, "You have to go in person to four meetings." And I guess I don't know if I want to ask you this because I want you to only answer it in one way, which is, I'm like whacking myself because, well, on one hand, I'm trying to like, okay, I have to feel my way into this. And I've actually talked to some other women from my Sangha and from that retreat, two other ones, that yeah, they're saying the same thing. Like, even though they drink less and less, they still feel horrible about it. And one of, they're interested in maybe joining me, but I just feel like this thing, like if I'm not willing to go back to AA, I'm just fooling myself. But some of the stuff you said was very helpful too. Like, I really need to be much gentler with myself about this. It's only been like the thing ended. The retreat ended on the 13th. I haven't partake with anything. I've gone 8 months and I've gone 4 months and I've done, and then I'll drink, a half a glass of wine a couple of nights, a half a gl bottle of wine a couple of nights in a row. And so it's been confusing. Because, like I said, I know I am. I know I'm not gonna, so even though you might say we'll have to join AA, I'm hoping, I mean, like, I don't know, because there's this thing, like, you're just fooling yourself if you, and
I hear you. I'm not here to tell people what to do. It's not my job. And there's people who get sober without ever going to an AA meeting. It's not what we would call the easy or softer way. I do think that some kind of community support is really, really helpful. And just hearing you sharing, there's a bunch of people, I know a bunch of people on this screen who are, hearing you and caring about you and feeling touched by you and feeling connected with you. So you're already not alone, and the fact that you just spoke is that's it. I mean, you're doing the work already. Like that's what it's really about. Because it's the thing that, to me, okay, first of all, I don't think it's important to call yourself an alcoholic or not an alcoholic. The question is alcohol making your life better? Basically. And when you've decided that it's not, and that's, you don't have to like, oh, I'm an alcoholic. Well, I'm not an alcoholic, so I'll drink. Like, I'm always like, why does that make, how does that make sense that I decided I'm not an alcoholic, so I had a drink? It's like, that's ridiculous. That's like, oxymoronic. So, just keep showing up in wholesome places, in good places, with Sangha, with recovery folks, whatever, whether it's AA or not. You might find an AA meeting where that you like. They're all different, and yeah, I mean, there's stuff I don't like about AA, so, but
Yeah,
it's not the.
I think the problem for me about it, by the way, I know your friend Suzanne. I think I've seen you before. She
Oh,
saw me
okay.
upon Marketplace. Have you finally gotten sober or what? But anyway, I'm very attached to the Dharma. I really am deep in with it. And AA is, I just feel like I'm very happy there. The friends I have in there know about where I am with it. And some of them are want to join me in this pursuit, and others like support me. And why am I telling you this? I don't know. It just, oh, I don't want to take, I guess I'm ha really like, I have a lot of friends now, which I did, I've been really lonely my whole life, pretty much, or too much. And now I've really found, this is my home group in a way. And I really don't want to shift that whole thing. I think the Buddhism is just totally cool. I really do. I'm totally into it. And that's why it's really hard to think about. I mean, I get what you're saying, and I know I don't want to take up too much more time, but that's why if I didn't already have this and I hadn't already tried that, which doesn't mean that I might not. But I've looked around for a lot of meetings. I might still, but it's just hard because I really love the Dharma and, retreats and the Sangha I'm part of and my teacher. And it feels like it's too much to try to do.
Who is that teacher, if you don't mind my asking? Matthew?
Yeah. And I also go to Will's Sangha. Matthew's
So,
pushed me into like, you've got to stop.
you're in the Bay Area. You're in.
Yeah, I've met you at Will's retreat.
Oh, good. So you should come next week to my
I'm planning on it.
the
Although
monastery. Good,
last
good.
time it was a disaster. There were weird people, not weird, but very disruptive people. So I haven't gotten to come back, but I will come.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you're showing up, and just keep not drinking. That's a good start, and you'll figure it out. More will be revealed, as we say.
Thank you.
I wanted to respond to Robin's question about have I published translation of the Serenity and Lord's Prayers in One Breath at a Time. In chapter 11, in the step 11, there is my take on the Lord's Prayer. So there's that. Deborah, there's a couple people who've put their phone numbers in the chat, by the
Oh,
way, for you.
okay. All right, I'll write them.
And they are both longtime members here, and
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I'll vouch for them.
I will put that on my thing. Thank you.
And just to remind people, I know people don't always go through the whole chat every time, but we do have a kind of sign up sheet that's on Google that people put their phone numbers or email addresses and sort of contact information to support each other.
It's on
So,
here. It's on the messages. So,
yeah. So, yeah, you might find some more friends.
thank
So
you.
I promised that I would do I didn't promise, but I said that I would do the loving kindness phrases again today. So I will do that before we close. So we can all take a breath. And radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. And once again, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outward and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Oh, may all beings be free from suffering.
Thank
Thank
you.
you. Thank you all for showing up.
Thank you,
And
Kevin.
thanks
Thank you,
for
Kevin.
all the questions. It's great to not have to think up something to talk about.
Namaste.
Thank you, Kevin.
Peace.
Thank
And
you.
you know, don't forget to vote. Or register if you haven't. All right. Take care, everybody.